Chapter 5, Why Analysis is So Hard, The 7 Deadly Biases. There is no perfection in our business. George Tenet, CIA Director, 1997 to 2004. The ambush came on an icy November night. In 1950, United Nations forces led by American and South Korean troops were marching north toward the Yalu River border separating North Korea from China. Their mission, rout the North Koreans, reunify the Korean Peninsula, and score a decisive win against communism. In the mountains, temperatures dropped below zero, freezing American tank treads to the ground and cracking the windshields of reconnaissance aircraft flying overhead. From the distant comforts of his Tokyo headquarters, General Douglas MacArthur directed troop movements that spread his men and supply lines dangerously thin. Although some worried that his northern gambit might provoke China to intervene in the war, MacArthur didn't. Intelligence reports from the CIA and Joint Chiefs of Staff estimated that China's new communist regime would likely limit its interference to covert assistance of North Korea, since large-scale intervention risked igniting World War III between the Soviet Union and the United States. MacArthur's own intelligence division in Far East Command believed that, at most, China could send 50,000 to 60,000 troops across the border. And even if that happened, Chinese forces would eventually be defeated, since they were ill-equipped, poorly trained, and operating without air support. There would be the greatest slaughter, MacArthur assured President Harry Truman a few weeks earlier. MacArthur was so convinced victory was around the corner, he told Truman the troops would be home by Christmas. Some of his men were already planning a victory parade in Tokyo. They would never get one. Instead, nearly 40,000 would return home in coffins. On the night of November 26th, approximately 300,000 Chinese troops began swarming out of the snow-covered peaks, blaring bugles, hurling mortars, firing machine guns, and hammering UN forces. It turns out that Chinese soldiers had been hiding, undetected, for a month, attacking in small skirmishes that concealed their numbers and lured MacArthur's men into the trap. The effect was devastating. Within weeks, UN forces lost thousands of men, 200 miles of territory, and the advantage in the Korean War. MacArthur was sacked, an inglorious end to a storied military career. When the fighting ended in 1953, it left a Cold War geopolitical deadlock, a divided Korean peninsula, and a brutally repressive communist North Korean regime in place. China's surprise entry into the Korean War was a hinge of history moment. Over the next half century, North Korea would grow more destitute and dangerous, dedicating its resources to building a clandestine nuclear weapons program and incarcerating more than 100,000 political prisoners in a vast gulag, while leaving 3 million people, or 12% of its population, to starve to death. Today, South Korea is a wealthy democratic ally of the United States, with per capita GDP of $39,000. North Korea is one of the most impoverished and repressive states in the world, with a per capita GDP of just $1,700 and a growing nuclear arsenal. While history is always filled with uncertainties, the trajectories of the two Koreas reveal the enormity of one critical juncture and the monumental price of intelligence failure. China's surprise attack highlights the pitfalls of intelligence analysis. In the fall of 1950, there were plenty of clues about China's actual intentions and capabilities picked up from prisoner of war interrogations, human intelligence from North Korean locals, reports from Chinese nationalists, intercepted communications, photo reconnaissance, captured enemy documents, diplomatic messages transmitted through the Indian ambassador to China, K.M. Panikkar, and even public statements by Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai himself. The failure came in interpreting what all those signals meant. MacArthur and his G2 intelligence chief at Far East Command, Major General Charles Willoughby, misread nearly all of the intelligence they received. Others did too. The question is why? Many have laid the Korean War intelligence failure at the vainglorious feet of General MacArthur. It is certainly true that MacArthur lived in a dream world of self-worship, as historian William Stook put it. But there's more to the story. There usually is. Whenever disaster strikes, it's tempting to blame individuals, but the sources of intelligence failure almost always lie deeper. This chapter takes a look at intelligence analysis, examining why it's often so hard to see what there is to be seen. The answer lies in two sets of factors: natural variations in the predictability of human events, and the limitations of human cognition. The world out there is inherently hard to understand, and human brains are not wired to understand it well. As we'll see, MacArthur suffered an extreme case of very common afflictions. He allowed optimism to cloud his assessment of facts, discounted evidence that contradicted his prior beliefs, and built a team around him that discouraged dissent. The most important lesson from Korea isn't that MacArthur failed in unique ways. It's that he failed in ordinary ones. The cognitive filters that all humans use to process information can lead even the most determined leaders in the most important moments to fail. In recent years, researchers and intelligence officials have been seeking ways to better spot and avoid these kinds of cognitive traps. Advances in artificial intelligence also offer promising ways to help analysts find new insights and contend with a crushing volume of data in the digital age. But vexing challenges remain. Estimating the future is a hazardous occupation in many occupations. Everyone knows that predicting the future is hard. Even experts with access to the best data are often wrong. Doctors offer incorrect diagnoses. Bankers get initial stock prices wrong, as we saw when Uber, Peloton, and Lyft went public. Hollywood executives are surprised by sleeper hits like Little Miss Sunshine and blockbuster bombs like Green Lantern. Political pollsters get surprised on Election Day. In the 1948 presidential election, analysts were so sure New York Governor Thomas Dewey would defeat incumbent President Harry Truman, the Chicago Tribune emblazoned its oversized headline, "Dewey Defeats Truman," when it went to press. Truman had a field day when the election results came in. In 2016, pollsters with advanced data analytics didn't do any better. Four models tracked by the New York Times gave Republican candidate Donald Trump a 15%, 8%, 2%, and less than 1% chance of winning against Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. Even statistics guru Nate Silver put the odds of a Trump victory at just 29%. But we often forget that some things are much easier to predict than others. The foreseeability of the world out there varies in systematic ways for systematic reasons. The predictability spectrum, four key factors. Predictability lies along a spectrum. Sports contests sit on the easier end of that spectrum. Assessing how national security threats will unfold over time sits on the opposite, much harder end. Four factors explain the difference, and why intelligence analysts have a much tougher job than other professions that peer into the future. Data, data, data. Data is a key ingredient to predicting the future of anything. Analysis is an exercise in causal inference, understanding what causes are likely to produce what outcomes. But not just any data will do. To be useful, data has to cover comparable events or circumstances. The more similar situations you can see, the more insight you can gain about likely causes and effects. Sports competitions are data rich. They involve repeated play, consistent rules, long-running programs or competitors, and statistics covering just about everything, from the post positions of Kentucky Derby winners to the batting averages of every professional baseball player since 1871. Sportscasters don't always get it right, But comparable data reduces uncertainty and increases prediction accuracy. In sports, winning against the odds is exciting precisely because the odds are usually right. Exactly how often in the past 80-plus years has the worst-ranked team in an NCAA men's basketball bracket won it all? Never. History is not destiny, but in sports it's a pretty good guide. Intelligence analysts, by contrast, usually don't have anywhere near that kind of rich comparable data to help them assess future geopolitical trends. When the Korean War began in June 1950, data to help discern the intentions of China's new communist regime stretched back just 8 months. Mao Zedong had won China's civil war and established the People's Republic of China on October 1, 1949. No American intelligence analyst could look at the history books to get a good read on how Mao had dealt with past foreign invasions of neighboring states who were ideological allies at the dawn of a Cold War, because none existed. Or consider the current nuclear crisis with Iran. Only 10 countries have ever acquired nuclear weapons. 5 got the bombs so long ago, handheld calculators hadn't been invented yet. North Korea is the most recent nuclear rogue, but the Hermit Kingdom's ruling family hardly seems a generalizable model for anything. And even if it were, how much do we really know about how North Korean leader Kim Jong-un thinks? North Korea has been such a hard intelligence target. As late as 2009, the CIA was building its dossier on Kim through the secondhand reports of a sushi chef. South Africa is the only country that has ever developed a nuclear arsenal and then voluntarily dismantled it. But that's not a generalizable case either. At the time, apartheid was crumbling, and the outgoing white regime feared putting the bomb in the hands of a black government. While sports analysts can estimate this year's outcomes by leveraging literally thousands of data points, nuclear analysts trying to mine history for insights about Iran have a grand total of 10 unique cases over 75 years. Asymmetric information. The second factor making some things easier to estimate than others is asymmetric information. In sports, the same information is generally available to everyone. Coaches may have inside knowledge about the mood of their team or how good they looked in practice, but critical information is in the open. Nobody is hiding this year's rankings or a season-ending injury. The only real limiting factor to obtaining data is time. How much of it you want to spend watching ESPN or digging through statistics. In geopolitics, the same information is not available to everyone, regardless of how much time they have. Intelligence is in the business of unlocking other people's secrets and protecting our own. Asymmetric information is the name of the game. And in a world of asymmetric information, prediction is much more difficult and miscalculation much more likely. Douglas MacArthur had some intelligence about China's troop movements and willingness to intervene in the war, but he found out too late that it wasn't the full picture. On October 15, 1950, just as MacArthur was reassuring President Truman that China would have the greatest difficulty of getting more than 50,000 across the river, tens of thousands of Chinese forces were secretly doing just that. By October 19th, 260,000 Chinese fighters were hiding in the Korean mountains. The Chinese were working hard to conceal their movements, including wearing their jackets inside out so the white blended in with the snow. China's surprise attack relied on asymmetric information. Asymmetric information problems don't just come from adversaries. Even within the intelligence community, the same information isn't available to everyone. In part, this stems from classification rules that tightly restrict who has access to what. There are good security reasons for this kind of need-to-know compartmentalization, including limiting the risks that an intelligence target like Osama bin Laden could be tipped off and slip away. and mitigating the damage of a potential cyber breach or mole. The downside of need to know, however, is that analysts frequently have different pieces of information and face enormous barriers to sharing it. Imagine scattering 20 years of NCAA basketball tournament data across 1,000 people. Now imagine that most of them do not know each other, and many don't know the value of the particular piece of information they possess. Some have no idea how the game of basketball is played because their expertise lies in other sports. They're all told if they share anything with the wrong person, they could be disciplined, fired, even prosecuted. But to succeed, they somehow have to collectively pick this year's winning team. Many factors explain why the right information often does not get to the right people at the right time in the intelligence world, including bureaucratic turf protection, agency cultures, career incentives, ingrained habits, and a desire for autonomy. In the Korean War, MacArthur and Willoughby, his intelligence chief, deliberately kept the CIA out of the loop because they did not trust the fledgling intelligence agency and because they wanted total control over their wartime intelligence. As one scholar wrote, MacArthur didn't want second-guessing by his subordinates or outside interference by Washington, even though second-guessing is exactly what good intelligence analysts are supposed to do. 50 years later, the FBI and CIA failed to share information about vital clues that could have unraveled the 9/11 plot because working across agency lines was an unnatural act for both agencies, and it had always been that way. At the FBI, agents are not trained to share information with other agencies, Attorney General Janet Reno told the bipartisan 9/11 commission that investigated the tragedy. Nor are they evaluated and rewarded based on their ability to generate and share information that other agencies might find useful. While counterterrorism intelligence sharing has improved significantly since 9/11, information asymmetries still abound. As one senior intelligence official put it, no one's career is ever ruined by being too restrictive about classified information. When is a win a win? The third factor influencing predictability is whether outcomes are fast and clear. This is a big deal. Rapid, unambiguous outcomes make it possible to develop feedback loops for analysts to improve their predictions over time. It's easier to learn from your mistakes when you know you've made them. Wharton psychologist Phil Tetlock, the leading scholar on expert judgment, is a fan of feedback loops. As he and Dan Gardner wrote in their book, Super Forecasting, to learn from failure, we must know when we fail. The baby who flops backward does. So does the boy who skins his knee when he falls off the bike. And the accountant who puts an easy putt into a sand trap. And because they know, they can think about what went wrong, adjust, and try again. Failing is easier to see in some areas than in others. One reason meteorologists have gotten so much better at weather forecasting is that they have great feedback loops. Gauging accuracy is fast and obvious. In weather forecasting, long-term means next week. It snows or it doesn't. Nobody's ever unsure whether there are hurricane winds gusting outside. Meteorologists make many predictions, can tell easily and quickly whether each one was right or wrong, adjust their models, and try again the next day. In sports, too, outcomes are unambiguous and instantaneous. Everyone knows when a win is a win. Analysts can look at their prediction track record and examine whether they put too much weight on the wrong variables or let their biases skew their judgment. More on that in a minute. In foreign policy, though, winning and losing are almost never clear. Is ISIS on the ropes or on the rise? Is maximum pressure against North Korea working? Will the U.S. war in Afghanistan ever succeed? Who got it right or wrong? It's hard to say. And the answer today may be different in a month, a year, a decade, or a century. Success is especially hard to see in intelligence because so many factors influence policy outcomes, and because intelligent success sometimes means preventing bad things from occurring in the first place. As former CIA Deputy Director John McLaughlin told me, success is sometimes woven invisibly into the fabric of a successful policy. The Balkans, the uniting of Germany within NATO. And sometimes success is nothing happening. An embassy is not attacked because intelligence warns and no one ever hears anything. It's difficult for analysts to get better at predicting when they don't know if their past predictions were ever any good. Denial and deception. The fourth factor affecting the prediction spectrum is denial and deception, or efforts to conceal what you're doing and deceive the other side. Sports coaches engage in some denial and deception, using codes to hide their play calls or using a trick play in a big game, for example. But this is small time compared to what countries and transnational actors do to conceal their intentions and capabilities and lead other intelligence services astray. In 2016, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un staged a fake missile test by doctoring old video. During the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, Russian leader Nikita Khrushchev outright lied to John F. Kennedy, assuring the American president that Soviet arms shipments to Cuba were purely defensive in nature. In the Korean War, Mao's troops went to extraordinary lengths to cloak their movements across the Yalu River, including disguising themselves as refugees, avoiding all radio, telegraph, and telephone communications, and constructing wooden bridges that were painted the color of water and submerged just below the surface. During the Revolutionary War, General George Washington created phantom camps, wrote phony battle plans and letters designed to fall into enemy hands, and even shipped fake gunpowder casks filled with sand to trick the British into thinking the Continental Army was bigger and better armed than it was. Denial and deception efforts are not rare occurrences in international politics. They're everyday life. Wars are won and lost, and countries are helped or hurt by how well they can hide critical information and manipulate the other side into believing things that are not true. Nobody doubts sports data. A home run is a home run. But in geopolitics, data is always suspect. In short, there are predictable reasons why everything in the world is not equally predictable. For intelligence analysts, the degree of difficulty is high. Data shortages, asymmetric information, weak win-loss feedback loops, and the prevalence of denial and deception activities make geopolitical trends and events much harder to predict than other things. The seven deadly biases. The problem isn't just the world out there. Sometimes the problem is us. Psychology research finds that humans rely on mental shortcuts to process all the information bombarding them each day. These shortcuts are extremely useful, enabling faster thinking and efficient decision-making. We use them without even thinking about it, skimming Yelp reviews to pick a restaurant, watching shows recommended by Netflix's search algorithm, and voting party line tickets rather than carefully assessing each candidate for every local position. But mental shortcuts are also prone to error. To see this in action, consider one of the early and controversial experiments conducted by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, pioneers in the psychology field. Participants were given the following description about an imaginary woman named Linda. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with the issue of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. They were then asked which was more probable. Linda is a bank teller. Or, Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. Between 85 and 90% of participants in the study chose number 2, Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. Kahneman described this outcome as totally contrary to logic. All feminist bank tellers are also bank tellers. So number one, Linda is a bank teller, always has a higher probability of being true. The math doesn't lie, but the brain often does. Economists and psychologists have discovered so many cognitive biases. Wikipedia currently lists nearly 200. 7 are especially pervasive and consequential for intelligence analysis. I call them the 7 deadly biases. Confirmation bias. Humans are not objective, no matter how hard they try to be. Researchers have found that people are wedded to their initial beliefs and will rationalize like nobody's business to cling to them, even in the face of contrary evidence. People tend to seek and latch on to information that confirms their pre-existing beliefs while avoiding, disregarding, or minimizing evidence that challenges them. In a now-famous psychology experiment, my Stanford colleagues Lee Ross and Mark Lepper, along with psychologist Charles Lord, recruited 24 undergraduates who supported capital punishment and 24 who opposed it. All 48 students were then shown 2 studies with equivalent evidentiary standards. One contained evidence that capital punishment deterred future crime. The other contained evidence that it did not. Ross, Lepper, and Lord found that students discounted whichever study conflicted with their already held beliefs about capital punishment, and they accepted the study that confirmed their policy preferences. Students' objective analysis of facts was colored by their prior beliefs, and they didn't even know it. Confirmation bias has dogged good analysis for centuries. In Roman times, the imperial physician Galen was so confident in his remedies, no evidence could prove him wrong. He famously wrote, "All who drink of this treatment recover in a short time, except those whom it does not help, who all die. It is obvious, therefore, that it fails only in incurable cases." Francis Bacon warned of the dangers of confirmation bias in 1620, writing, "The human understanding, when it has once adopted an opinion, draws all things else to support and agree with it." 3 centuries later, in the Korean War, Major General Charles Willoughby suffered from such severe confirmation bias that even when UN forces started encountering Chinese troops on the battlefield weeks before the massive November ambush, Willoughby invented ways to downplay and dismiss the information. On October 25th, the first Chinese prisoner was captured. He told interrogators that he was a regular soldier in the Chinese Communist Army and that there were tens of thousands of Chinese soldiers in the mountains nearby. The report immediately went up the chain to Willoughby, who sent word back that the prisoner must be a Korean resident of China who had volunteered to fight. Over the next several weeks, American and South Korean forces took more Chinese prisoners, who reported that they had crossed the Yalu River in large numbers. Each time, Willoughby minimized the significance of their reports. In 2002, as war was brewing in Iraq, confirmation bias again led to intelligence failure. In October, Congress received a National Intelligence Estimate, or NIE, about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. NIEs are the most authoritative assessments produced by the intelligence community. They are considered the gold standard, harnessing the best insights from the best information across the entire intelligence community. This particular NIE contained several alarming assessments. Among them, Iraq was at that moment reconstituting its nuclear weapons program and seeking a nuclear device, had restarted its production of chemical weapons, including mustard, sarin, and VX, and had probably amassed substantial chemical weapons stockpiles. And Iraq had expanded and advanced its bioweapons capability since the first Gulf War, including developing mobile biological weapons production facilities that could evade detection. every single one of these judgments turned out to be wrong. After the United States invaded, the CIA and Defense Department organized an international fact-finding team to hunt for evidence of weapons of mass destruction and any associated research or infrastructure. Called the Iraq Survey Group, the team never found evidence of a reconstituted nuclear program. They found a trace amount of chemical weapons believed to be left over from the Iran-Iraq War and not enough to be militarily significant. They concluded that Saddam Hussein had destroyed his bioweapons program back in the 1990s. The mobile bioweapons capability that could evade detection was actually a phantom, peddled by an unreliable human source, codenamed, of all things, Curveball. Former CIA Director John Brennan called Curveball a fabricator, and the estimate seriously flawed. How could so many smart and dedicated intelligence analysts have been so wrong? The bipartisan Silberman-Robb Commission conducted a post-mortem that reviewed thousands of documents and interviewed hundreds of experts inside and outside the intelligence community. Its unanimous report identified many causes of failure. Confirmation bias was a big one. It appears that in some instances, analyst presumptions were so firm that they simply disregarded evidence that did not support their hypotheses, the report concluded. As we saw in several instances, when confronted with evidence that indicated Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, analysts tended to discount such information. Rather than weighing the evidence independently, analysts accepted information that fit the prevailing theory and rejected information that contradicted it. On the basis of what coalition forces discovered after the first Gulf War, intelligence analysts knew that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had developed clandestine weapons of mass destruction programs in the past. A decade later, they assumed he was probably developing weapons of mass destruction again. It wasn't an unreasonable assumption, but it was an untested one, and that made all the difference. Analysts begin to fit the facts to the theory rather than the other way around, the commission concluded. It was a classic case of confirmation bias. Optimism bias. Optimism bias is a close cousin of confirmation bias. Put simply, optimism bias is wishful thinking. It's everywhere. Researchers have found that people believe good events will happen to themselves more than others, that their own investments will outperform the average, that their favorite sports team has a higher chance of winning than it actually does, and that their preferred presidential candidate will win even when the polls say otherwise. People are also wildly optimistic about themselves. Large majorities believe they are smarter, more talented, better looking, and even better drivers than the average, even though it's statistically impossible for that many people to beat the average at anything. Optimism bias has its benefits. Without it, college dropouts like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs would never dream of risking it all to start Microsoft and Apple. Optimism bias helps drive humans to overcome failure and try again. But in the realm of foreign policy, it can be deadly. Politicians can be highly susceptible to policy proposals claiming favorable estimates of success, whether it's humanitarian intervention in Somalia, war in Libya, or renewed sanctions against Iran. The leaders of nearly every country involved in World War I predicted that victory would be swift and easy. "Give me 700,000 men and I will conquer Europe," said General Noël de Castelnau, chief of staff for the French army at the outbreak of the war. Castelnau got 8.4 million men, more than 10 times that number he said he needed. But Europe was not conquered. It was decimated. The war took the lives of nearly 40 million people and ravaged economies and societies. In the Korean War, Douglas MacArthur and Charles Willoughby were so hopeful for victory, no amount of intelligence suggesting otherwise was sufficient to change their minds. According to an expert review of the Korean War intelligence, both men, along with other intelligence officers, received numerous reports that Chinese forces were massing in Manchuria, as many as 450,000 men. MacArthur and Willoughby agreed that China was deploying large numbers of troops, yet still concluded that China was unlikely to intervene in a major way. Optimism bias kept them from considering bad outcomes that might have been avoided if only they had been recognized. Optimism bias more often affects policy decisions than intelligence analysis, because intelligence officials are naturally prone to pessimism. Their mission is considering downside risks and seeing dangers before it's too late. CIA Director John Brennan brought bad news to the White House so often, President Obama took to calling him Dr. Doom. Nevertheless, intelligence analysts are not immune to this cognitive trap. Availability bias. Humans are atrocious at understanding probabilities. Ever wonder why people are more afraid of dying in a shark attack than a car crash, even though fatal car accidents are about 60,000 times more likely? Or why tornadoes is seen as more frequent killers than asthma, even though asthma causes 20 times more deaths? It's not because people are stupid. Even smart people with advanced degrees miscalculate probabilities. Instead, the problem is availability bias. People naturally assume something they can easily recall is more likely to occur. The human brain confuses the availability of a past memory with the likelihood of its future occurrence. Even though they're statistically less likely, vivid and horrifying events like shark attacks are generally easier to remember than everyday occurrences like car accidents. Intelligence analysts, like everyone else, have to contend with the risk that availability bias can skew their judgment in hidden ways. We can see the powerful grip of recent experience and how different intelligence analysts viewed information about whether the pacer walking around a suspicious Pakistani compound in 2011 was actually Osama bin Laden. As recounted in Chapter 4, estimates about whether they had found the Al-Qaeda leader ranged from 40% to 95%. Those who had lived through the intelligence failure of overestimating Saddam's weapons of mass destruction programs were more skeptical of the intelligence, and they issued lower probability estimates that the pacer was bin Laden. While those coming off recent counterterrorism successes put more stock in the intelligence and issued more optimistic assessments. What you predict depends on what you've experienced. The fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error is the tendency to believe that others behave badly because of their personality, while we ourselves behave badly because of factors beyond our control. People often jump to blaming others while letting themselves off the hook. Drivers think that someone cutting them off must be a jerk, rather than wondering if there's an emergency or some other reason requiring them to drive that way. College students often say, "I got an A," when they do well in a course, but "the professor gave me a C," when they do poorly. In foreign policy, the fundamental attribution error fuels misperception. As Kahneman and Renshaw wrote, a policymaker or diplomat involved in a tense exchange with a foreign government is likely to observe a great deal of hostile behavior by that country's representatives. Some of that behavior may indeed be the result of deep hostility, but some of it is simply a response to the current situation as it is perceived by the other side. What is ironic is that individuals who attribute others' behavior to deep hostility are quite likely to explain away their own behavior as a result of being pushed into a corner by an adversary. History is filled with crises in which one country either overestimated the hostile motives of another or underestimated how threatening its own actions could appear to the other side, or both. Take, for example, the first Gulf War and the Iraq War. in which both the United States and Iraq largely misunderstood the other's view. Iraq underestimated the United States' risk tolerance following the Cold War and 9/11. And the United States failed to see that Saddam was much more concerned about the Iranian threat than the American one. In both 1990 and 2003, an incomplete picture of the other side's intentions and motives led to costly conflict between the two countries. During the Korean War, many U.S. officials believed that marching through North Korea toward the Chinese border would not be seen as threatening to China. Washington authorities, most notably the Joint Chiefs of Staff, seemed to believe that as long as direct clashes along the Yalu could be avoided, so too could war with China. Hence proposals by Army Chief of Staff General J. Lawton Collins that MacArthur stop 5 miles from the border, noted Elliot A. Cohen in his 1988 analysis of the intelligence failure. Secretary of State Dean Acheson went so far as to claim that no possible shred of evidence could have existed in the minds of the Chinese communists about the non-threatening intentions of the forces of the United Nations. American leaders knew that their own intentions toward China were not hostile and assumed that Chinese leaders knew it too. And even when China entered the war, American officials attributed it to China's inherent hostility toward the United States rather than to it being a reaction to MacArthur's advance beyond the 38th parallel.